Fox versus PBC Productions. Mr. Deming? I met Mr. Denny. Would you go to the microphone, please, so we can record you?
I am William Denny, representing the plaintiff in this matter. I have with me Jonathan Cermelli, who will share that responsibility with myself this morning. If the court please, I would like to open with some general comments and then turn the argument over to Mr. Cermelli, who will go into more detail.
Okay. Mr. Right. Denny, proceed.
In brief, this case involves defendants who, for the purpose of making a profit, put on sporting events and sell admission to those sporting events. The defendants are the owner of the business premises involved, the host hockey team involved, and their insurance company. By a stipulation identified in the record as R38, they are united in their defense. The plaintiff, simply put, is a member of the public for whom an admission was paid to attend the sporting event in question. In our briefs and in our presentation today, it is our position that the trial court and the majority of the Court of Appeals were overly concerned about the defendant's right to make a profit while not giving adequate attention to the right of the plaintiff to receive reasonable care on the part of those who were trying to make a profit through the price of the admissions they received. This, I think, you will find record support for in pages 12 and 13 of the Court of Appeals decision, where they say, as noted by the trial court, if we're going to enjoy sports, we're not going to make them unduly burdensome for owners of teams to present to the public. We have to take a look at what the viewing public has a responsibility here for. We say that the responsibility of the defendants here has largely been ignored. Now, we go back to the Paulus case, which this court adopted long before the adoption of the Restatement of Torts in 1963. And we don't read that Paulus case, we hope that you don't read it in the way that the trial court and the Court of Appeals did. They read right out of it the obligation of the promoter to provide screening or protection for those attending the sporting event who want such protection. In other words, for those who are there and are unwilling to assume the risk of being hit by whatever object is in play.
So, Mr. Denny, is that the, let's say, instead of using the slippery slope argument of where is it stopping, so you're saying that if you are to prevail, this court should find that there's a difference between spectators who are in the protected area behind the glass, behind the netting, and those that are out in the bleacher seats, so to speak, and there isn't any netting out there? That seemed to be in the Paulus case you're talking about. The court talked about the person sitting behind a protected area vis-a-vis one who's in an unprotected area.
That is the position taken by this court in Paulus.
Okay, and you want us to follow that?
I have no problem with the court adhering to that. It just seems to be a reasonable position to take.
So that people that are in an unprotected area where there is no netting would be treated differently, is that correct?
In a baseball game.
A hockey game?
Well, hockey is not the same as baseball. Aside from the fact that you've got a black object in play in one, hockey, and a white object in play in baseball, In baseball, it always is hit at or near home plate. It always comes from the same place, and you can plan for that. In hockey, it can come from anywhere. And we have, in the record that was before the trial court and the Court of Appeals, the admission of the Admiral's management that you cannot see the hockey puck coming. It comes so fast when you're sitting low in the stands. Francis Eddy said that. An employee of the Admirals for 20-some-odd years.
What does your position mean, that they've got to have a partition all around the ring?
That would have to depend on circumstances. Here, we have a situation where it's undisputed that there were 87 prior recorded injuries at the Bradley Center. That's kind of shocking, I thought. Do you think some analysis would have to be made as to why this is happening? I haven't gotten to the point I was going to try to make before sitting down. The state has adopted the restatement back in 1967. We first adopted 402A as against those entrepreneurs who try to make a profit by making and selling a product. Judge?
Are you distinguishing between this professional hockey league and an amateur league? Say, what difference would it make if I'm at an amateur hockey game and the same thing happens? Is that the distinguishing characteristics if they don't charge at all? It's a high school game.
If the amateur hockey game is being run for a profit, if it's a business...
Well, what if it's a high school... they play a lot of high school hockey.
Then I think there's a distinction that this court can afford to solve that.
So the difference is for profit.
For profit. And that's why we're suggesting in our briefs that this court follow the lead the Colonel case out of Illinois, where they referred to statement as subsection 344 of this restatement of torts, which places a very distinct responsibility on those who own premises. And if you just take a look at 344, it's quoted in the Colonel case that we've cited.
Yeah, but the Illinois case talks about that was where a spectator was hit in an unprotected area, and they allowed recovery. I think they're one of the few states that allow recovery for someone being hit in an unprotected, non-netted area. That was the Illinois case.
If you don't mind, I'm going to let Mr. Cermelli respond to that.
Yes, Justice Wilcox, Jonathan Cermelli for the petitioners. You're right. Illinois is one of the few cases that has allowed recovery for a spectator injured in an unprotected area. To clarify some of the court's previous questions, I think if you take a look at the Paulus decision, sitting in a protected area versus not sitting in a protected area is not the sine qua non. There are a host of decisions or factors that went into Paulus. Namely, number one, the plaintiff's there, failure to take any precautions at all for her own safety. Sitting in the protected area was one factor, a very important factor in Paulus, and a very important factor in our case, too. If you look at the Colonel decision and the Riley decision and the Yates decision, those are the three Court of Appeals decisions in Illinois that we've cited to that have adopted either specifically 344, the restatement second torts, or adopted the implications behind that, I think you'll find that what the courts have said is that a business owner that opens their premises for business upon which a patron of that business, in our case a spectator, is injured, simply owes a duty of reasonable care, of ordinary care, to protect and to warn. And we're suggesting that this court should follow that lead, nothing more. Now, that duty of reasonable care, while it hasn't been specifically adopted per se by this court under 344, Restatement Second, it certainly was implied in Paulus, in Lee versus National Baseball Club, and in Kaiser versus Cook. Now, in Paulus, we know that the court could have could have dismissed the plaintiff's action, saying there is no duty of care here owed by the baseball owner. They didn't do that. Rather, they looked to contributory negligence principles. In Lee, the Supreme Court let stand a verdict of negligence, okay, implying again that the owner of the club or the club itself owes at least a duty of ordinary care. In Kaiser versus Cook, this court, now that's a little different. It was a racetrack injury, but nevertheless, you have a spectator attending a business event for profit who's injured. And in Kaiser, the court reversed the trial court's ruling that the plaintiff was, as a matter of law, more negligent than the defendant. This court said, unless we're going to hold racetrack owners completely immune from liability, then mere attendance alone at the event doesn't bar the claim. And I'm afraid mere attendance alone is what the trial court latched on to, and it's also what the Court of Appeals latched on to. The trial court said, and this is at page 40 of the appendix, as a matter of law, you're more contributorily negligent for just going to the game than anyone who's hitting the baseball or anyone who owns a baseball team that hits the baseball. The majority of the Court of Appeals said, Powis prohibits a spectator who is injured by flying baseball from making a claim against the team or other responsible parties. That's at page 11 of the majority opinion, Your Honors. Now, I'm afraid what that does is that revives assumption of risk as a complete bar to a negligence claim. Now, the Court of Appeals took pains in a footnote to say that we're not doing that. But I think the language of their decision and their adoption of the trial court's rationale indicates otherwise. That's a concern for me.
Now, but the assumption of risk and contributory negligence come very close together.
Yes, ma'am.
The difference between the assumption of risk and contributory negligence, at least in this state, has been that the assumption of risk is a total bar. Contributory negligence is a bar to the extent you're contributorily negligent. And the issue here is whether or not there's any negligence, and two, whether the negligence outweighs or is greater than the negligence of the defendant, which in effect would put them out of the realm of recovery for damages, right?
If I think I'm having a hard time hearing, Your Honor, but I think you're correct. The issue, we know from Polsky versus Levine that assumption of risk is not supposed to be a complete bar. So
we're going to have a hard time hearing you if you don't understand.
I'm sorry. So Polsky versus Levine says assumption of risk is not a complete bar. What it is, it's one fact to take a look at. Just as this court in Rockwright said that open and obvious danger is one fact you take a look at in terms of determining whether the owner of the premises, in that case the landlord, owes a duty of reasonable care and whether they've met the burden. What we need to do is look at the plaintiff's actions in our case and find as whether the plaintiff, who also owes a duty of reasonable care, which this court said in Powis, the injured spectator owes a duty of reasonable care to protect herself. Did she adhere to that?
So my question to your colleague was, you know, we're talking about a logical stopping place here, and he mentioned the 87 prior incidents. So if I understand this, that what you want is a duty of reasonable care, and then these 87 other cases in this just one sport in a National Hockey League team in Milwaukee would have had the potential of 87 more cases, which a jury would be able to assess whether or not it's reasonable that the accident happened. Is that what I'm concerned about here is that it's for any pay. Where do we go as far as if we are we going to have some distinction here? Your distinction is, well, it's a netted area, it's for pay. This is the type of question that the court is, or at least I'm concerned about.
Understood. And it's a reasonable concern. You know, are we going to see, if you rule in favor of the petitioners, just a flood of hockey injury cases?
Well, there were 87 potential cases in just this one little area.
In 5 years, Your Honor.
All right.
In 5 years. All right. How many of those 87 injuries were to persons who took every precaution they could for their own safety, or were to persons who sat behind the plexiglass screen provided by the respondents to protect about safety? I don't know that. I don't know that. My guess is it's pretty small.
But I think there's a potential for each one if we're looking at a ordinary negligence, reasonable care situation. That's all I'm asking is what you think would happen there.
There is a potential, and the question is, should it get to the jury?
Right.
By all means, it should.
Counsel, the Mulas Court of Appeals characterized as its decision is twofold. Number one, that Mulas failed to show there is a material issue of genuine fact. Number two, that the baseball rules apply. Tell me what genuine issue of material fact you believe exists in this record so that summary judgment should not have been granted.
Well, I think, number one, whether the respondents at that level or the defendants at the trial court took reasonable care in terms of allowing the plexiglass screen to be 4 feet lower in the midsection of the rink than it was at the end of the rink.
As I read Kaiser and as I read Palace, you don't get to that if you find that your client was negligent as a matter of law. That's what Kaiser said. Kaiser said that Palace didn't get to the safe place issue because they found that the plaintiff in that case had not taken sufficient precautions. So what other facts are there?
Well, Your Honor, I think you're right that Powell says the first thing you have to do is look as to whether the plaintiff took sufficient precautions.
Okay, so the facts that you have to show are plaintiff was not negligent, that there's an issue of fact as to whether plaintiff was negligent.
There is an issue of fact as to whether the plaintiff was negligent. That's correct. But you also have to look as to whether this is a contributory negligence scheme that they're trying to determine on summary judgment. I think that itself is a slippery slope. Trying to determine that the plaintiff itself was contributory negligent on summary judgment prior to determining whether the defendant was negligent at trial, at jury, is a scary situation.
As I understand it, in 1976, we changed the rule. Previously, assumption of risk was an absolute bar to recovery in the state of Wisconsin. When was Paulus decided?
1958, Your Honor.
So that it was operating under the law that it was still assumption of risk was an absolute bar, or didn't it employ that?
That's my understanding. And yet the court rationalized the plaintiff's actions, not in terms of assumption of risk, but in terms of contributory negligence. That speaks to the power of Paulus, all right, that they don't want to find a spectator for merely showing up to see the game, assuming the risk, and not being able to make any claim at all if they're injured. You know, we don't assume the risk for injuries the second we get into our car anymore. There's a presumption that we're going to act with due care for our own safety, and that's what the Paulus Court granted to the plaintiff in that case, the presumption that she would act with due care. If she doesn't, then it's proved otherwise. If her contributory negligence is so great, the quantum is so great, then that's something we have to look at. But Paulus said, remember, that the plaintiff took absolutely no care for her own safety. I see that the warning light is on.
Mr. Cermelli, let me interrupt you at this point and ask you about Section 895.525. Quite obviously, that's a statutory section that seems to encompass somewhat the idea of assumption of risk. The language itself talks about the participants in a sporting event accepting a risk. How do you view that statute in the light of your circumstances in this case?
Well, Your Honor, as I understand it, 895.525 was the legislature's response to this court's ruling in Mustina. And I don't think it's appropriate here. Why? I don't see a spectator at a sporting event being involved in the event. We're not talking about two football players and one gets injured. We're not talking about two soccer players where one gets injured. We're talking about a person who goes to an event, either sits in an unprotected area or doesn't, sits in a protected area, and whether that person uses ordinary care to protect herself or himself. I don't see that statute as applicable.
Do you have any case law that would support that position?
Other than, well, 895.525 so new, I don't have any case law that would support that position on that statute. However, I do think that Paulus Lee versus National Baseball Club, Kaiser versus Cook, all give the plaintiff a burden of ordinary care to protect himself or herself and put the same burden of care on the business owner who puts on the sporting event or who owns the baseball team.
Do you perceive the Paulus case as a declaration that the spectator was, as a matter of law, more negligent than, was always more negligent, or do you view it as a simple, putting it into today's terms of how negligence law has progressed over the years, a matter of proximate cause, that is a matter of public policy? The court would not allow the suit to proceed.
Your Honor, I'd like very much to answer that. My red light is on.
You may answer.
Okay. I think that the Paulus case says that when you take absolutely no precautions for your own safety, you are, as a matter of law, more negligent than that of the baseball team.
So, if I can follow, the way I've looked at this case, I've looked at it as a normal negligence case. The Admirals own a duty of care to the whole world, and the question becomes whether or not we should, assuming that they are negligent, whether, as a matter of public policy, we should allow a case like this to go forward. And I ask myself, where's the reasonable stopping point? And I guess your answer would be the reasonable stopping point would be that we limit these cases to those instances in which the individual has taken care to try to protect himself or herself, and nevertheless injury occurs.
That's our position, Your Honor. And it has to be a factual determination. And I'm sorry, but the trial judge can't make that factual determination on summary judgment. So it necessarily needs to go to the finder of fact as to whether that plaintiff took adequate care. In each case, it's going to be a factual determination.
So you're saying that these cases should get to the jury, and that, I guess that was my concern, that this would be something the judge could not handle on summary judgment.
The red light's still on. May I answer that? I think it depends upon the facts. If you've got a Paulus case where the plaintiff's quantum of negligence was so absurd, then I think the court can take that as a matter of law. You've got a Moulis case, it's completely different. It should go to the jury. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. You have time for rebuttal. Mr. Spencer, you may... Fine. You can raise that podium by a button on your left.
May it please the court. We view this case as a simple sufficiency of the evidence case. There is no evidence from which to conclude that the Admirals and the Bradley Center were negligent in providing the reasonable care that professional hockey teams provide in like or similar circumstances.
Was that what the court found here?
That was the first issue, yes.
All right. Repeat what you say the court found on the first issue.
That there was no evidence to support the conclusion that the Admirals and the Bradley Center were negligent. No evidence from which to infer that after reviewing the affidavit submitted by the plaintiff. Basically, the evidence submitted by the plaintiff comes down to this. The affidavit of Ms. Moulis' brother says the walls could have been higher, and the affidavit of her attorney says there could have been netting. But none of that goes to show what other professional hockey teams or other hockey teams anywhere do to protect patrons and their spectators at their sports.
Counsel, as I looked at it, I thought, at least for purposes of argument, what Ms. Moulis may be claiming here is that essentially the Admiral set a trap, that she thought she was protected because of the 8-foot-high plexiglass. She intentionally sought those seats in order to give herself protection, and yet, in fact, she wants the question to go to the jury whether or not that did provide the protection, and that she said it didn't. Somehow the trajectory of the puck coming over that plexiglass caught it.
See, I don't believe there's any evidence in the record to support the contention that she sought out those seats. Mr. Moulis's affidavit at paragraph 2 says, I bought the tickets to be as close to the rink as possible, like any good sports fan would want. Paragraph 5 of his affidavit says, I didn't think it was possible to get hit in those seats. But it comes short of saying, I bought those seats for protection. Then when you look at Mr.
But she's entitled to all the inferences. And isn't that a reasonable inference from that statement that she bought those seats in order to get protection?
Well, I don't think there's... Mr. Moulis bought the tickets, and there's nothing in his affidavit that says I bought them for protection. Her affidavit says it was my understanding that my brother bought them for protection. But there isn't anything that says I chose those seats for protection. There is a statement that says I didn't think I could get hit in those seats, but there's nothing that says I specifically purchased those for protection. And I think even if she believes that she could not be hit in those seats, that's an unreasonable assumption in this case. When you look at the photographs that were submitted as part of the evidence, there's clearly space above her head, around her, that is not screened in any way.
What's the duty of care? What's the standard that you would say this court should use, that your client would owe to spectators?
I think it's to exercise reasonable care that other hockey facilities do in like or similar circumstances. It's a regular negligence standard.
Is it the exercise of reasonable care to have plexiglass at the 8-foot height where it was?
I think it is. I think it provides reasonable protection for the straightest and the hardest of the shots.
And maybe you think it is, and maybe someone else thinks that isn't, and isn't that an issue for the jury to determine?
It would be an issue for the jury if there was any evidence that came forward that says 8-foot is not reasonable, and here's why. But when everybody else, when all the other professional hockey teams are doing the exact same thing, that shows evidence of due care.
But that shows evidence of due care. Custom in the industry is evidence that is weighed, but it's not conclusive evidence. That's one of the ingredients that you put in the mix for the jury to determine. It seems to me.
True,
do you disagree with that? Do you think that custom in industry is conclusive as to the issue of negligence?
Where there's no countervailing evidence, I believe it is. And in this case, there's no countervailing evidence. When there's an avalanche of custom in the industry, unless the custom is contrary to common sense, statute, or public policy, that holds, my belief.
Where your proposition is that you need, and the proposition of the Court of Appeals, the first part of the opinion, is that there needs to be evidence of violation of standard of the industry in order for there to be liability. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Do you think that a person can be found negligent, an entity can be found negligent without expert testimony in a safe place?
It depends on the case and the nature of the testimony. I think some circumstances are so common to everyday life that you don't need expert testimony, for example, water on the floor.
Why isn't this common? I look at the pictures contained in the appendix. One shows the Bradley Center and the other shows an alternative, the alternative being a safely, obviously, environment. My common sense tells me that. Why can't a juror look at those two pictures and say, looks to me like the 8 feet plexiglass may not be as reasonably safe as it could be. Look at this other picture.
Because there are a lot of factors that are beyond the normal expertise of lay people to decide. For example, standing here, I don't know what's the maximum size you can make one of these panels and still have it structurally sound so that when people crash into them, they're not going
to
break.
Now, the jury would like to hear that, and they could assess it, correct?
And I don't know, I think you need an expert to say, if it's 8 feet high, it's going to shatter with so many pounds of pressure. If it's 12 feet high, it's going to shatter with so many pounds of pressure. That's beyond what I think most juries would understand. And there are other factors, too. For example, with the sight lines being impeded to the extent that spectators would no longer want to come to Admiral's hockey game, would the installation of the panels become so difficult when the transition is made from basketball to hockey that it's just not practical to do it anymore?
Well, but counsel, don't your own records indicate that this is an unsafe place? You give a warning on the microphone, don't you, saying beware of flying pucks or words to that effect. which means that you haven't protected these people. I mean, just your own indication says that. And then there's a real question as to whether you should. And that's, it seems to me, like a jury question, but it seems to me that part of the case is pretty standard stuff as to negligence and summary judgment. I would like to move you for a moment as to the, let us assume that there could be a finding that you were negligent. Let's just assume it for a minute. I want to know, what is your position on what the participant has to do? Is it your position that mere attendance alone, as a matter of law, to a dangerous game like hockey, is adequate to prove contributory negligence that exceeds yours, whatever yours is?
I think that's going to depend on a case-by-case basis. I think mere attendance would probably not be sufficient. I think attendance with a degree of knowledge, and I think the MODEC case from Minnesota is on point, where it says it does not take a person of ordinary intelligence very long to appreciate the fact that hockey pucks can and do rise from the surface of the ice.
I've never been to a hockey game, so I'm now going. Before I read the record in this case, I mean, records we read really teach me a great deal about life. So now I'm going to a hockey game, and I haven't read this, and I sit behind, I don't sit behind the plexiglass because I'm not smart enough to ask for those seats. Or I'm smart enough to ask and they're all sold out. Okay? So now I'm sitting in that seat and I'm paying close attention, but I don't see it coming. Apparently comes pretty fast. I might not see it. Or if I do see it, there's nothing I can do in the split seconds that it reaches me. So am I more contributory negligent than you are negligent?
I think at that point you are. I think if you're not watching the game carefully...
I'm watching. It's too fast. How fast does that puck come?
On shots, it can go upwards of 100 miles. But shots that go into the audience aren't necessarily going to be 100
no,
miles.
No, but let's say this one is one of those at 100 miles. You think I can do anything? I see it leave the ice. What can I do?
How good is your hand-eye coordination? I guess I have to ask. Very bad. I apologize.
It's normal, but I doubt that I'd get it up. And
I think that's a risk that you assume going to the hockey game.
Then you're back to that mere attendance alone is adequate.
I think that once you have the knowledge that hockey pucks leave the surface of the ice and can go into the audience, you've made a choice that that's a risk you're willing to take.
So you've told me. The ticket says so. I don't know if your ticket says so, but if it doesn't, the next ticket will say so. And you keep telling me on the loudspeaker, beware of the puck, right?
Correct.
Told me that before the game?
Correct.
Told me that during the game?
Before each period, yes.
Okay. So I've been told, right? And if I came late, that's my fault, right?
I would agree with that.
Okay. So that means that mere attendance alone knocks me out of a lawsuit.
I think mere attendance with a couple of knowledge. I think, as the MODEC, I go back to the MODEC decision.
Okay, so if you told me,
right,
that's okay. And even if I missed the announcement.
If you're told and if you attend that game for more than 5 minutes, I think you'd appreciate the fact that the puck can go out of the ice surface.
5 minute rule.
I think that's fair. I think it's a knowledge requirement. I think once you've seen that that's a possibility and you have that knowledge, for example, in the Paulus case, they decide, and in the Lee case too, they talk about how, you know, it's such a common experience that people in Wisconsin would know that foul balls get hit in the stands. You see it on TV. You see people chasing after them. The announcers at that time had a fishnet out to retrieve foul balls. It's just a part of common experience in Wisconsin. That people would know that a hockey puck can leave the surface of the ice and go into an audience.
But, counsel, I don't have a lot of problem with the general rule that mere attendance does bar a claim. But I do have a problem when the person seeks out protection, thinks that they are protected, and in fact are not.
I don't think an unreasonable belief of safety is sufficient on her part.
Well, isn't that a question for the jury, though? Jury to go to the scene, to take a look, to try to put themselves in the mind of the person of Ms. Mulas and say, no, would I think that I was protected sitting at this length from any flying pucks? I mean, I don't have very good eyes. If I were to go to a hockey game, I've only got one eye, in fact, I'd look for the plexiglass, and if not, then I'd want to sit way back where I couldn't get hurt. But if I sit where I think I'm protected, behind plexiglass, and nevertheless that puck comes over and hits me, shouldn't I at least have the right to go to a jury to get the jury to determine the negligence?
Well, our duty is to provide reasonable protections, not to provide perfect protection.
But you can't set a trap for a person. You cannot, don't you agree that the admirals cannot provide what appears to be protection but is not protection at all?
I don't think the admirals made any representation that those seats were safe. They're not, you know, sit here and you won't get struck. There's no odds laid out in the seat. Your chances here are 1 in 10, or your chances here are 1 in 1,000.
But you don't think that the presence of the plexiglass creates that impression?
Do I think that? No. I knowing that it's open to the roof, knowing that pucks can arc, slice, go through the air at any particular angle, much like a golf ball, I wouldn't presume to say that a piece of plexiglass there is going to protect every shot. I think they protect the, I would say, if I was sitting in that seat, that I have reasonable confidence it's going to stop the straightest and the hardest shots, but every single shot, I don't think that's possible to predict.
So if it had been 12 feet, there's no guarantee it was going to protect.
There's no guarantee.
15 feet.
There's no guarantee.
So if it didn't go up to the ceiling, there's no guarantee.
There's no guarantee.
Now suppose I agree with Justice Babbage, and so now I'm knowledgeable and I say I want the highest barrier. What's your highest barrier when I buy my ticket? And the answer comes back 12 feet, and I say, okay, that's where I want to sit, and far back. I'm told no seats. So I then give my little letter to the to you people saying, I've tried to get what appears to be the safest seat, but you are unable to supply it. I am going anywhere, but the risk is on you, not me, because you have not supplied me with the safest seat. And I give you that as a certified, and I send it by registered mail, and I put it on my email to you, your box office. So I've done everything I can to warn you, don't mess with me, right? And that's what I'm doing. So now I'm hit.
I would say that's your fault, not ours, because you come with the knowledge. My response would be, if you want perfect protection, then you should watch the game on television.
Counsel, what you're arguing is two things that strike my mind. Number one, I believe you're arguing for a return of assumption of risk. And number two, you're arguing contrary to the holding in Kaiser. Let's talk about number one. You've said mere attendance and the general knowledge of the dangers of hockey, that a puck can fly and hit you, is sufficient to bar, as a matter of law, recovery of the plaintiff.
Yes.
That sounds like assumption of risk to me. Mere attendance. How do you square that with the court's holding in Kaiser at page, looks like, 468, where it says in Kaiser, it's true that Mrs. Kaiser voluntarily attended the racetrack, but unless racetrack operators are to be completely immune from liability, this fact alone cannot defeat her right to recovery.
That's why I add in the knowledge requirement. Because I think mere attendance is probably not enough, but I think some level of knowledge is necessary.
Well, let me qualify then. It's your position that anyone who lives in Wisconsin who is familiar with hockey or has attended at least one game has an absolute bar to recovery by mere attendance. Is that correct?
I would agree with that.
Now look at Kaiser. She had been there how many times prior, she had been to races? How many times prior to the race in question?
I think she'd been to races in general in the mid-50s. I think her attendance at that particular track was two or three times. And I don't believe she'd ever seen a tire go over the fence before.
Well, the court says, as to the other factors, Mrs. Kaiser did not realize that watching from the curve would be more dangerous than sitting in the grandstand, nor was she aware that tires would fly into the spectators' area. She could reasonably have believed that she was watching the race from a safe location. It seems to me that discussion is saying, look, she didn't necessarily seek out the safest place. You don't have to seek out the safest place. She could reasonably believe where she was a safe area, regardless of trying to get right behind the plexiglass or trying to get right behind home plate. There's no requirement to seek out the safest place in order to be able to bring a cause of action, is there?
I believe that's a factor that goes
into... It goes into the mix for the jury to determine. Is that correct?
I don't believe it's a jury question in this case. The question here is, did they provide the reasonable protection that you would ordinarily seek in a hockey arena? And I think once that protection is found, I think that the fact that whether she seeks out the safest seat or not, it still shows that if she has the knowledge to say, I want the safest seat, as opposed to, I want this seat that's not safe, it still shows her knowledge that once... That there are risks involved in attending the game.
And that's a factor to consider, what she did, whether or not she was looking at the game. Isn't that what the cases also say? Are you paying close attention? I mean, that's a factor to consider. And Paulus, she wasn't paying close attention here.
I agree that those are all factors cited by the Paulus court. Yeah.
You mentioned an interesting situation of a golf match, where the people pay money to get to see the pros, and they're standing all the way along the side of where the women are hitting the ball to the next hole. Suppose ex-President Gerald Ford is up at the tee, and it's been known all over the country he doesn't always hit straight. May the person like Chief Justice Abramson stay in that front row in order to see the president and then get hit in the head? She assumed that.
I think if she's got the knowledge that Gerald Ford is not our best golfing president, I think that's the risk she assumes. I don't think you can walk into a situation with the knowledge and then say, well, I know that I can get hit, and I know there can be a problem, but it's your fault if I do.
You use the word risk she assumes, which I guess is another word for us, a term for assumption of risk. But that's not really what you're saying, is it? Because in Wisconsin, we don't recognize assumption of risk as being a bar to recovery. What are you really saying?
I'm saying it's a...
As a matter of law, she's more negligent? Or are you saying that as a matter of public policy, she should not be allowed to recover because there would be no reasonable stopping point?
I'm saying both, I guess.
Okay.
Well, there's a reasonable stopping point. It's the spectator standing there. I mean, it's not like you're going out to the world. There's a reasonable stopping point in hockey. It's all the people in that rink. It's not like 6 million people. It's whatever that rink holds. In the golf one, it's a limited liability to all the people that are standing there. If the ball crashes through a TV set, you're not liable. It's the spectator. So I don't know that it's unlimited. It's not like something that you don't know who all the plaintiffs are. You've got a limited number of plaintiffs. If you don't want them to be liable to them, you don't admit them. Or you make them stand far back. Might sell fewer tickets. But why do you think... I mean, I haven't seen anything in these cases in Wisconsin that deal with public policy that you're liable with that we're limiting liability. The cases say you're not liable. Or the racetrack was potentially liable, depending on what the jury found. And in Paulus, this is not liable because, as a matter of law, the negligence was great.
Well, I guess I get to be the first one to argue that to this court, then.
Yeah. Did you argue that in your brief?
Pardon? Yes.
Where in your brief did you argue public policy?
Public policy is in the second section.
Where? I didn't see it.
The Court of Appeals did not address the issue. It's been briefed all the way along from the trial court into the Court of Appeals.
You say the second section. You're talking about where in your brief?
Public policy includes liability in this case. This is the second section beginning at page 17.
Mr. Stadler, in your brief, you seem to rely to some extent on 895.525.
and you indicate that spectator equals participant, because participant, of course, is the term under the statute.
Right.
Do you have any basis or any authority for that?
I have no case law in Wisconsin for that. My view is that you do not necessarily have to be doing the activity to be a participant in that activity. Spectators at hockey games chase pucks, they cheer, they do the wave. My view is it's not working, it's not sleeping, it must be recreating, and I think that makes that person a participant under the statute.
Are there other states that have similar statutes that have holdings that might be of assistance to
the party? Not that I'm aware of. Are there any further questions?
You did once in your argument, or maybe twice, use the word of, in place of assumption of risk, let me see if I can find what it was, you used another word, you accept, the person who attends accepts. Is that tantamount to assumption of risk?
I think so. I think that they, once there's a knowledge either implied or from the experience, I think they make the choice and they accept the responsibility or accept the risk of attending that event.
Well, you're saying accepting the risk of reasonable hazards. In other words, the example that Justice Babbage gave of sitting behind the plexiglass, if I did seek a place up in the top of the arena and still got hit, there's no protection there. And that would be distinguished, at least under the example by Justice Babbage, from the person who was sitting behind the plexiglass that was seeking the safety of that glass or that protection.
See, the protection protects those that are up at the top of the stadium as well as it protects those that are close by, because the puck has to leave from the surface of the ice, and depending on the angle of the shot and the speed at which it comes, it can protect people that are up here because it would hit down here at this level, or it can protect people closer in from ones that are straighter shots. So the protection that's there, it protects everyone in the stadium.
But hockey pucks, and I've been to hockey games, can go anywhere in the arena. I mean, frankly, they can zoom out, go way up, hit the roof, and then drop down on someone's head who's sitting behind the plexiglass, for example, as this was alleged to have done, is go up, over, and then curve down, which is a natural thing for a hockey puck, just the way it's designed. That's the way it travels. It doesn't travel in a straight line.
That's true.
But the Justice Abramson was trying to say that we don't owe a duty to the world, but just the people in the stadium, just the people in the arena, and what about that argument?
I agree. We have a duty to provide reasonable protection that people in like or similar circumstances provide. And I think the evidence that this stadium complies with what is done at NHL stadiums and International Hockey League stadiums provides the evidence that shows due care was exercised here.
Well, you slipped in something there. You said we have the duty. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I'm just going to say that I asked the other counsel this question about what effect this will have on amateur sports, but for pay, for profit, where soccer, baseball, hockey, anything of that nature, that if we were to say that you owe this duty of care, then it would be a jury question in each case, correct?
That's correct. And I think I addressed that in my public policy concerns, which is if we're going to demand that perfect protection be afforded in all circumstances, from baseball to golf to hockey, we do risk putting high schools and colleges and small colleges out of the sports provider.
Well, they could always buy insurance.
Right.
Counsel, what I was interjecting was, you seemed to slip into the duty of care. You said something like, you have the duty to provide what others in the industry provide. Standard industry is only an element to consider in the mix of negligence. It is not dispositive of the question of negligence.
That's true, I think, in cases where there is countervailing evidence, but in this case there is none.
Well, there was some countervailing evidence, arguably, that it could have been safer, take a look at page 38 in the appendix. You have a picture there that shows how it can be safer. There was other evidence in the affidavit that there should have been signs. There was a question as to whether or not the announcement was made that day at that game that apparently they say they normally make. So there were questions.
Well, for example,
there were issues.
You're pointing to the photographs of the Pettit Center, mm-hmm. which, as pointed out by the trial court, is a completely different facility from that of the Bradley Center. People who go to the Pettit Center are paying to skate around an oval track and may not be in a position to pay attention to a hockey game that's going on. And professional hockey games are not played there. That's for club hockey and high school hockey. So it's a different type of facility. There isn't any evidence that netting or screening at one facility is appropriate for a place where people pay to go watch hockey or where professional games are played. So I would still say that there is
There's no evidence one way or the other on that?
There's no evidence that what's appropriate for a facility such as the Pettit Center is also appropriate for a facility such as the Bradley Center.
There's no evidence one way or the other on that. There is no evidence right. that it is. There is no evidence that it isn't.
That's correct.
What can I do as a spectator going next week or next year, whenever? What can I do to protect myself? So suppose I buy a helmet and a face mask and wear appropriate soft-shouldered stuff or buy appropriate things that you might wear in other sports. An actual participate. What can I do? And suppose I do all that and then get hit and it injures me anyway. What do I do then?
My view would have been if you had knowledge that this was a possibility about being struck at a hockey game and you were concerned about that, as I said before, your best bet would be to watch it at home.
So that my point is then that no matter what I do to protect myself, you are immune from liability. I mean, that is what your position is here.
My position is that we've provided reasonable protection under the circumstances.
But you agree it is not even close to 100% protection.
That's correct.
In fact, it's below that. So I can't do anything. I just can't go.
But
you are totally immune.
But our duty is to provide reasonable protection, and I think that's provided there. It doesn't have to be perfect protection.
Right. But your position is that you're immune.
I guess I'm confused by the word immune.
Okay. Your position is everybody who goes to the game, no matter how attired, no matter where they sit, cannot win in a lawsuit against you. Because your stadium, your hockey rink is protected adequately, reasonably.
Right. Given that there is no evidence that someone conducted a study and that there is some sort of testimony that if it was just 3 feet higher, that should be the league standard as opposed to what it is now. If there was expert evidence that suggested if it was 12 feet, that's the perfect amount of protection because it blocks so many more shots or whatever. Some sort of challenge, if you will, to what the industry standard is.
The risk comes out of the game itself. Your role, if I fall down on your steps in your hockey arena, that's a different situation, or the seat collapses or something like that. That's different.
That's correct.
But what we're talking about is the game itself and the risks that come out of that game.
That's correct. I see that my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Jenny?
A few very brief comments. I think counsel overlooked paragraph 2 of the affidavit of the plaintiff's brother, in which he said, "I purchased 2 season tickets for the Milwaukee Admiral games to be played at the Bradley Center during the 1994-1995 season. For the protection of myself and guests, I wanted the seats to be as close as possible to the plastic screen surrounding the rink." That's a given. Also a given is that we have in the evidence undisputed showing that for approximately 50% of the perimeter, they were able to provide a 12-foot high screen. And if you find the time to go into the excerpts that we have provided you from deposition testimony of the Admiral's management, you will see that they were unable to explain that 4 foot height, 4 foot in height reduction, except to rely on phantom rules that they never produced. There's one affidavit of Mr. Berry, which I look at as nothing more than opinion. It's not fact as to what the rules are. And even if the rules did say that, that's like putting the cat in charge of the canary for the league to determine what its safety responsibility is, and not for this court or the legislature.
So you're saying that this court should set safety standards for hockey?
No. I'm saying that you should not accept the rule that the league or an industry, for example, can set its own safety rules.
Well, who would set them then?
I think either the legislature
or this court,
or the courts in the system of deciding cases would determine what's reasonable under the circumstances.
It seems to me, Denny, that you're asking for the jury to determine it.
Yes, ma'am. But here, in this case, all they rely on, and no one of the management was able to explain why, except for these phantom rules, they could not put it 12 feet high all the way around. That's the total point in their
evidence. So my question would be, if it's 12 feet high and the puck comes over the top and hits someone below that, they would be more negligent or less negligent?
Well, that depends, Your Honor, in part upon whether or not they gave an adequate warning. If you've had time to look through the Illinois cases, you'll see that down there they've made clear that the cases of this sort, Section 344 of the restatement applies. We haven't found a case in Wisconsin where this court before has taken up 344 in the context of a business-for-profit situation. There was one reference to it in case of a college campus or whatever, but this court has not addressed that to our knowledge. But in 344 of the restatement, it expressly states, if a possessor of land holds it open to the public for entry for his business purposes, is subject to liability, the members of the public, and so on, and they have to use reasonable care. That's the premises, the person that owns it or controls the premises, to discover such acts are being done or are likely to be done, or give a warning adequate to enable the visitors to avoid the harm or otherwise to protect them against it. The record in this case shows two totally inadequate plain warnings. They're pages 1 and 2 of our reply brief. One is called Notice of Restricted License, and the other one is called a Special Reminder. In our reply brief, we suggested to the court that a proper warning on the facts of this case would be: warning, patrons sitting behind and below the top level of this screen are not protected from injury by flying pucks. Pucks leaving the rink sometimes come so fast that you cannot see them. Those are undisputed facts. The management of the Admirals conceded that. You'll find that in the testimony of Fred Scazzetti. That's, ladies and gentlemen, we submit, would have been an adequate warning that would give the plaintiff serious problem in this case.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes our argument in Molas versus PPC Productions. So the court will take a few minutes break so that the students from Beaver Dam